From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bill Harley says stories aren't just for campfires or festivals. He often talks about how crucial stories have been in the way we developed as a species. Harley says humans evolved to make sense of their lives through the patterns that come in a narrative. We're not built to memorize lists or unrelated facts, he says. So when he talks to teachers, he often suggests that they ditch the lecture from time to time. He tells them to stop and say, "Let me tell you a story," and watch what happens. Faces relax, he says. People settle in. They drop pens. They stop tapping away at screens. And they get ready to find out what happens next. Bill Harley is in Utah this week to talk about stories and to tell some. He's joining us today. We hope you will, too, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bill Harley has been at this storytelling thing for decades now. You may have heard him in a classroom or at a festival. You probably heard him on NPR's All Things Considered. So you know that Bill understands intuitively how stories work. He knows how to tell them, when to pause, when to unload the punchline. But it's only been recently that he's realized just how intimately connected we are as a species to stories. Harley says that we're built as a species to communicate, to make sense of our lives through the patterns in a story. Bill Harley is in Utah this week, a guest of the Writers at Work conference, and he's joining us today to talk about stories, maybe even tell a few or sing a few. Anyway, we invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Bill Harley is a singer, a storyteller, an author, a playwright, an educator. He won Grammy Awards in 2007 and 2009. He's published many books and CDs. His latest release is an audio collection of stories for children called High Dive. It came out earlier this year. And we'll tell you more about the Writers at Work details as we go. He's giving a concert tonight, by the way. Again, those details to come. Bill Harley, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Thanks very much for being
My
with
pleasure.
Us. Well, I hope this isn't an obvious first question, but what's the first story you remember?
Wow. You know, I guess I just remember, well, I'm just, this is completely off the top of my head. My mom was a children's writer, actually.
Huh.
She wrote for My Weekly Reader, and she
wow.
wrote for Basil Reading Books, which is a whole other thing. It's an interesting development in the history of literacy. And so she had stories that she had written for the back. Like one I remember, I guess it was, I mean, in some ways it was a printed word that I remember. I remember my mom bringing home Cat in the Hat. I remember one of her stories was Cousin Elmer's Planet, about a guy who built a rocket ship in his backyard and everyone laughed at him. And then there was another picture book I remember called Noise in the Night. Huh. And the kid can't find out. Every night he hears a sound. And when he goes in to wake up his parents, the sound isn't there anymore. And finally he realizes it's his father snoring. So it's stuff like that, I guess. You know, that's I mean, the stories I remember being told to me or read to me.
But I guess the question is were you surrounded by storytellers? I mean, were your families?
You know, it's a funny thing, but no. Huh. I mean, the books were always really important in my family, and literature was really important. I mean, I always say to parents that whatever you want your child to do, you should leave it around the house. So if you want them to be a musician, you have to kind of donate a couple instruments to the house, knowing they're going to be destroyed. And if you leave the books around the house, they're going to be chewed on. But that kind of ingestion of paper pulp is an important part of literacy. Mm-hmm. So there were books around our house. But the odd thing is my dad is kind of a quiet guy. Mm-hmm. And my mom's sense of humor is always very, very droll. So the stories that would come out, I realized years later, they're these little folk tales about the traveling salesman that she would never quite finish the end of them because they were inappropriate. But, you know, and it's like the traveling salesman, you know, and everybody would laugh. It's like the joke about, you know, number 47, that's not funny.
So. Yeah. But that's so interesting. As a person who tells stories out loud and we'll get to this, you know, talks about the importance of telling stories out loud.
I know.
That wasn't really part of your
childhood. It is a funny thing. I think what happened is, you know, when you get out of the house, but a lot of times it's not just what's in the house. It's the people that are around you, the adults that are around you. And a lot of times I think that you come at those things, those influences are kind of more oblique, that there's a you know, my scoutmaster actually was a it was just this incredible guy, and I tell actually a story about him in my newer recording. But you know, he told stories and encouraged us to tell stories, and that was so. You find those things from a different place, or you know, the weird uncle or somebody. Where yeah. the I think parents are a lot of times busy imparting. You know, the shoulds, and forget that they ought to just tell the stories about the things that happened to them.
You've talked about some of your influences, Bill Cosby.
Yeah, it took me a long time to realize how deeply I think Cosby influenced me. But I was one of those kids, you know, of the generation when Cosby was on Ice By, but he was also just releasing his first, you know, Bill Cosby is a very funny fellow, yeah. right, and wonderfulness, and to Russell, my brother, whom I slept with, which I consider really one of the great monologues about childhood and siblings.
And they were all stories.
They were all stories. You know,
not
Cosby,
set up punchline. They were
no.
stories.
No. Well, one of the things about Cosby, and I think that there is this understanding, I think Garrison Keillor has a sense, is that humor is about situation.
Yeah.
And then if you set up an honest situation, then funny lines come, but it's not about looking for the punchline.
Right.
It's looking about – you're looking for the humor in a human condition.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of inherent absurdity about it. And that's what – I think that's what Cosby did. And when I got into this and I kind of ran into, again, Gene Shepard,
yeah.
who had been on WR Radio in New York, and he tells this long stories about growing up. Most people know him from the movie The Christmas Story
yeah.
about the Red Ryder BB gun. But that was really an accumulation of all these stories he told. And that felt – there was a real resonance for me when I started to touch back with those stories.
So was the initial impulse for you, or the initial interest, was it I can't imagine it was that you're – I'm going to use stories to convey meaning to people. But it was part of it just that it was a great way to perform?
Oh, yeah. I think so. Without getting into too much psychology, you know, I'm the middle child, and I will just leave that one alone.
Right.
I don't know. Now, when I'm trying to explain myself, you're kind of grasping at straws, but I filled, if my parents didn't talk, I filled the void,
yeah.
I think is the thing. And it's very hard to be conscious of, even today, of who we are and what we do. But so I think I was responding to that. You know, that void and finding a way to talk about it. When I started to write songs, I was much more interested in the performers that put songs in context.
Yeah.
It was always frustrating to me to hear somebody and just do one song to another. I wanted to know where that song came from. And so when I started to perform, I was looking for those, you know, so like somebody like Arlo Guthrie or somebody who's got this facility with language too. And Utah Phillips,
yeah.
Bruce Phillips, when I saw him perform, it was like, that's the kind of thing I want to do. So you would take those kind of models on.
So did you think you'd ever be an actor? In some ways, that's kind of what you are. But did you ever think about it in that way? Or were you thinking you'd be a singer first?
Well, I think I was thinking about being a singer too.
Yeah,
I did
yeah, yeah.
a little acting in college, but not very much. I was more – and I think part of it too, I was more interested – in the creating side of it too, not using someone else's words but mine.
Yeah.
And I think there was that kind of notion of, you know, I kind of came of age late 60s, early 70s. There was a kind of notion of the singer-songwriter, the, you know, kind of the lone wolf out
yeah.
there for whatever. And
yeah.
that was so I think that was kind of the model. But as I got more into storytelling, it presented different issues and problems. But I've still – I work some with other people, but I'm still it's really kind of a solo endeavor.
You know, it's interesting. You you graduated from Hamilton College,
yeah,
and you got a religious studies degree.
Yeah,
what was that about?
Part of it was that when the time came to declare a major,
oh, really?
I said, "What do I have the most of?" I think a lot of people have been through that. But at that point, I was very much an activist at that time. I was an organizer on the campus and had been involved in a lot of things in high school, starting against the Vietnam War and the farm workers. And so in college, Gandhi and King and the Berrigans and all those people were really important to me. But the side benefit of that was I ended up having to study myth too, which isn't something I had intended on, but that was part of the regimen. And so I ended up reading Joseph Campbell and Marcia Eliade and all these people who were really working on trying to understand what was essential in the human condition and how that was expressed, and it was expressed through story. So kind of unwittingly, that became part of my work. So I was just – and both those strains still kind of run through everything I do.
Well, I'm going to come back around to the idea of myth, because in some ways you've talked about storytelling as kind of giving people a myth in some ways, or kids. So we'll come back to that. But Pete Seeger influenced you too. He's a great storyteller in terms
Pete,
of
singing. Well, and Pete was one of the ones too, because one of the first stories I ever told when I was working at a summer camp is I had learned Abiyoyo, which is a story he made up, or maybe his father made up. I can't remember. And it's based on a South African lullaby. Yeah. And every time I told it in the camp at the end of the day, everybody sat down and shut up. And it was one of the things that the thing, and it still is amazing to me in performance, there's always this moment when the story is going and I stop and the story is still going and I can see it in everybody's face. And it's not about me. It's about this space and these images that I've kind of been a conduit for. And that the wonder of that has never, ever left me if I get it right. And so that happened with Pete. And then, I mean, the other thing about Pete's is this commitment to a sense of justice and how important that was. And, I mean, he's just been so dogged about that through his whole life. And then also, and this has really influenced my performance, that I think Pete's shows have always been about the expression of community, that music and story throughout the history of humankind have been first about the expression of community. And that, you know, if you went to Pete Seeger concerts in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, you saw that his job was to get the audience to take responsibility for the show. And I remember seeing him once, and he was singing this Cristo Ya Nació, this song from Nicaragua, and it was very difficult. And he said, "We're not doing another song until you learn this one." And that was really brutal, because it was a very difficult song. But that was – he knew that that's your job. This is your job to learn this song. Yeah. And so Pete's sense of what performance is about was really important to me.
There's a song – I want to get you to play something. And I wondered if we could start with Enough is a Feast.
Oh, yeah. Let's see if I can do this. I actually let's hope I remember all the words, okay? I had written another song called Half a Loaf, and I was singing to a friend of mine, Nancy Schimmel, who's a storyteller in Berkeley, California, and her mother is Malvina Reynolds, who wrote Little Boxes and Turn Around. And I finished the song, and she said, "That reminds me of my mom used to say, enough is a feast." And so I wrote a song kind of like, I think, as Malvina would have written it. Okay. Sat at the table, I ate my meal. I asked my stomach, "How do you feel?" It told me, "I'm full." I said, "Are you sure?" It said, "You'll get fat if you eat any more." Enough is a feast, enough is a feast. Take what you need, save some for the least. Save some for the least. Stand at the door, enough is a feast, you don't need any more. I swear that it's wrong, I think it ain't right. Half the world goes to bed hungry each night. Some scrounge at the bottom, some lounge at the top. I think it's crazy, I wish it would stop. Enough is a feast, enough is a feast. Take what you need, leave some for the least, leave some for the least. Stand at the door, enough is a feast, you don't need any more. If I were a president, or I were a king, I'd just make a big pile out of all these darn things. All we'd have left were ourselves and our names. We'd all shake hands, start over again. Some people work, some people don't, some people share,
Some people won't. Some folks have nothing. Some have it all, but we're all stuck together on this little blue ball. Enough is a feast. Enough is a feast. Take what you need. Save some for the least. Save some for the least. Stand at the door. Enough is a feast. You don't need any more.
Bill Harley. His most recent books are Night of the Spadefoot Toads and Dirty Joe the Pirate. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's giving a concert at the Masonic Temple in Salt Lake City. Tickets are $20. It's a benefit for the Writers at Work Scholarship Program. Seats are still available. For tickets, call 801-996-3313, or you can buy them at the door as well. You can go to our website for the particulars. Bill is also giving a workshop as part of the Writers at Work Conference, which runs tomorrow through Sunday. For details, go to our website. We need to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
I swear that it's wrong. I think it ain't right that a billion folks go to bed hungry each night. Some scrounge at the bottom, some lounge at the top. I think.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about stories, how and why you create them and tell them. Our guest is the Grammy-winning storyteller Bill Harley. You've heard his stories on NPR. He's also a playwright and a musician. In fact, he has a guitar here with us in the studio. Bill is in town this week, a guest of the Writers at Work conference, and he's joining us to talk about stories. And we invite you to join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I've been thinking a lot lately about this idea of truth in stories. And we did this show a few weeks ago. It was after it was revealed that the storyteller Mike Daisy had kind of fudged some of the facts in that story he was telling about workers at the factories in China who make Apple products. And the question comes up, when is it okay to mess with the facts a little bit? And really, how much do we remember anyway? How are you thinking about that idea?
It's a really interesting problem. And, the thing with Mike Daisy is I think when he got into problem was he insisted that it was true.
Yeah.
And there's a great passage in one of my favorite books on storytelling is by Salman Rushdie. It's Harun and the Sea of Stories. Mm-hmm. It's a book he wrote for his son after he had the fatwa put on him. And there's a boy whose father is a storyteller, and politicians are always asking him to speak at rallies. And his son says, how come is that? And he said, well, people come to hear me, and the difference between me and a politician is a politician swear they're telling the truth and no one believes them. And I promise you I'm lying and you believe everything I tell you. So a story, is always a metaphor for something else. And when we get into this, did this actually happen? This actually happened. I mean, if I'm pushed out, I'll say no, none of it happened. But that's not true either.
Yeah.
So inevitably, memory is not what happened. Memory is the story we tell to explain who we are.
Right.
And as soon as we get into that, this absolutely happened this way, we're going to play gotcha. That comes back to me all the time in my stories, because a lot of my stories are about growing up or things that happened to me.
Yeah.
But I shape and form them, and I'm people come up afterwards and they say, was that true?
Yeah.
And what they're really saying is, can I believe you? Was this – and storytellers have a million ways to say, yeah, it is true in the way that you want it to be true.
I want to play – in fact, you say that very thing in a story that you told for NPR's All Things Considered several years ago. And it's about this very idea. I want to play this for people and then come back and we can talk about it. Here's Bill Harley.
Is that true? That's the question you want people to ask after you tell a story, because it means they want to believe it. But storytellers, as a rule, should not spend too much time insisting they're telling the truth. That's what politicians do, but not storytellers. Storytellers are comfortable with telling a good story. Whether it's true or not is up to the listener. I learned all this about 10 years ago when I was telling stories to an audience in the town where I grew up. I hadn't been back in years. I was on stage telling about something that happened to me in elementary school. There was a kernel of fact in the story, but it was more about the terror of childhood than my actual life. The fact is, I told the story so many times, I couldn't even tell what had actually happened. I knew part of it was made up. Then, in the middle of the story, I looked out in the audience and recognized a face I hadn't seen for 35 years. Rob Hensley. He looked the same. And then I realized he had been in the class I was telling the story about. And even while I was talking, I thought, uh-oh, he knows this isn't all true. I could see Rob was laughing at the story, but I felt like I'd been caught. He knows, I thought. After the show, I was in the lobby meeting people when Rob came over to me with a smile on his face. Rob, I said. You remember me, he said. Yeah, I said. I saw you out there. Great, he said. Wow, I can't believe you told that story about fourth grade. Neither can I thought. He smiled. It looked like a knowing smile. My confession was on my lips, and then he said, I remember that day. That was exactly what happened. How did you remember all that? He was smiling. I was speechless. I finally choked out. I don't know. I just did. That was so great, he said. I'd forgotten all about it. I nodded. Okay, I said to myself, maybe my imagination is more accurate than I thought. Or, as we say in the world of stories, never let what really happened get in the way of the truth.
So what's going on with Rob? You've given him now the kind of the structure to remember it? What happened?
Well, I don't think it happened the way I said it. I'm
right.
Pretty sure he didn't. But I think there's a couple things going on. First of all, the setting was accurate.
Right.
So the geography of childhood is, and when you get the geography of childhood right, people go right back there. And that's and the second thing is that the emotional truth of the moment was right. Then the story I was telling was about a teacher and who was very strict, but there was this kindness underneath her, and it was the discovery of this kindness. And incidentally, I was telling that story again back in the town where I grew up, and a guy came up to me and said, "Hi, I'm Mrs. Nottingham's son." And I thought, now I'm really in trouble because I kind of was hard on her. She was very strict. I saved her at the end. And I said, oh, and he said, that was my mom. That was exactly who she was. So that's true. And I think that what you're doing is I'm touching – you know, my job to tell personal stories is to remind you of your story. That's what a storyteller's job is. It's not about me. And people run into problems with personal stories when they haven't thought through what the subtext of the story and what the myth underlying the story is. And if they get that right, then they're going to reach other people. But if they're just talking to hear their own voice or they think their life is interesting, then it's not going to have the resonance, I think.
You've said that a storyteller connects us to truths, whether it's, you know, funny or sad or horrible. We're getting at, you said, some truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, about what the human condition is. And, you know, I very much consider that my work is to remind people of this kind of commonality that we have. And, you know, I travel some abroad, but mostly I've performed in 49 states at I don't know how many, 2,700 schools. I don't know.
Wow.
And what strikes me is that wherever I go, regardless of whether it's a, you know, inner city school in Birmingham or a show in Koskob, Connecticut, that there are these basic, as long as I choose my material correctly, that we're talking about a lot of the same things.
I wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure you've been giving a lot of thought to the history of storytelling and why it is you figure that we're so drawn to stories as a species. Do you think that you've talked about how stories have helped us, they give us a context for our lives, they help us make sense of our lives. So why are we so connected to them? Because it's not just entertainment, but it's not just conveying information either. What
well,
is it?
the I think one of the reasons stories work as opposed to just kind of dry information is that they're cognitive and affective, is that when there's someone in a story, when there's a storyline about something happening to somebody, there it's innate in us, you know, I don't know, they haven't found the gene on it, but to identify. Identification is central to human beings. And if you spend enough time with somebody, whether it's in a story or in a movie or, in real life, you start to care about what happens to them. And maybe we can do some kind of reductionist thing about exactly why that happens. But it is identification and this kind of consonance or resonance it's endemic to the human experience. So when you start to tell a story, you're introducing information, but you're introducing it in a way that affects us emotionally. And I think that that's the difference between a fact and a story. And the thing about an event doesn't mean anything by itself. Right. I broke my leg. That doesn't mean anything. I broke my leg after I jumped off the roof. That means a little more. I broke the gym after I jumped off the roof because my older brother told me it was safe to do. So now we begin to have a dynamic about the relationship. And the real story about that is not the breaking the leg. It's the relationship with the brother.
Right.
That's the subtext. So events don't mean anything by themselves. They only mean something when we put something before and after. And that's how meaning is communicated. That's meaning. It's context, and that's what story is.
There's a story that I wanted you to talk about because you talk about how it's this you had been telling this story to this group of sixth graders, and you started telling them about the hero story, and there's this kid, I guess he was in the back, maybe at least I imagine him in the back, right? Named Jamie.
Yeah,
and He's not really there in some ways, right? For day after day, as this thing is happening, Jamie's in the back. But it's a really amazing moment. I wanted you to tell that story.
Yeah, I've been working this school for a month, and I had kind of introduced these different stories, and kids were supposed to make up their own stories based on different structures, and we were doing this hero thing, which is like Joseph Campbell and his model. And this kid didn't do anything. And at the end of the time, I mean, the time is almost out. And I say I didn't have to fit in the curriculum, so it was fine. That's the luxury of not having a curriculum sometimes. He stood up and told the story about this boy whose father had died. And he decided to go to the land of the dead to save his father. And a helper gave him a sword. He's matched. And he goes to the land of the dead, and his father's in the house of the dead, and he slays the dragon that's protecting his father, and he brings his father home. And it's really a perfect myth. It's like Orpheus and Eurydice, you know, but it's like the successful one. You know, they get all the way home. And this kid hadn't done anything, and I just thought, he got this story from someplace else, which kids do. And I'm actually easier on that now because trying things on is important. But at the end of the class period, the teacher turned to me and said, Jamie's father died 3 months ago. And so when you give someone a structure like that, you begin to give them a way to make sense of things. Yeah. And I said, you know, in this talk I gave that, people say, well, Jamie's father didn't come back. But that's not the question. The question is, how do I make room for my father in my life? And you do that through, you know, speaking his name and telling stories about him. And that's how someone lives in someone's lives through that. And that's what he was doing. And that's how we use story.
What I think was so interesting about that is that in some ways you've talked about that's what a teacher is supposed to do then. Is to give a framework, but the idea is for them to come up with their own story.
Yeah, and I say that's what I say. I mean, the shorthand is the teacher's job is to give someone a story so they can make their own.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And we get so – I mean, it's like, don't get me going, but we forget. Like now, you know, when we – in English, we give people stories, and the first thing we do is take them apart and kill them. But we forget that it's the story itself that actually has the power. It's not identifying the characters and the plot line and the setting and all that stuff. It's how the story works in somebody that's most powerful. And we can't – the thing that's frustrating about that for someone who's very didactic and regimented and said, okay, now we're learning this skill, is the stories don't work like that. A really good story – I mean, there's some stories – that there are stories that I've learned early on and I'm still learning from them. that I learned from people. And every time I come back to them 3 or 4 years later, you know, you never step in the same river twice, yeah. right? And every time I look at them, they go, oh, it means this now, it means this. And that's very frustrating for somebody who's a very type A kind of person who wants the people to know this, because stories aren't like that.
Do you think this is one of the problems with education?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just...
Don't get you started, right?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I think that we just... I don't quite know what's going on. I mean, I think there's really a question about whether... I think there's really a question about whether public education is valuable to people, whether they think we really need it, or should we educate everybody, which is kind of what this country was – the notion this country was based on. And I'm not sure we hold that. But we've – part of that is this kind of saying, okay, we're going to teach them this and this and this and this. And I don't think learning is like that. My life as a storyteller has shown me that people learn when they're ready, and they learn in different ways. And they learn different things, and a good teacher has not one method, but 7 methods, depending, or 10 methods. And the more we break something down, the less there is to hold when we're finished. And we also, it's just not as much fun either.
Yeah.
So I have great concern, and I don't know how to stop it. I think teachers feel overwhelmed. I feel by this. You know, was No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top too. And I just, my friend Kevin Kling, who I guess you talked about, he talks about Native people, their basis of humor is who's doing this to me.
Right.
And I kind of feel like that about teachers, is teachers all over. It's like, who is doing this to me? So, and I'm not in of schools, but I'm in them all the time. Yeah. So I see this.
It leads us to a phone call, actually. Okay. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. And Louise is with us in Ogden. Louise, hi.
Hi. I actually am a teacher educator, work at Weber State. We've hosted Bill before at our storytelling
yeah.
festival. I prepare secondary teachers, and social studies teachers seem to understand the power of story in the classroom. But I would like to hear what Mr. Harley has to say about other content. How can a science teacher or a math teacher bring together the affective and the cognitive in a powerful way through story?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of ways. First of all, the stories about the people who did the work are almost always compelling. The people who made discoveries. Obviously, history is story, so that's easy. But in science, once again, it's putting the discoveries in context is a really natural thing. And when you scientists, as a rule, are unbelievably strange and weird, and there's a lot of stories about them if you pay attention. But through that, you know, you can take an atom through a trip through a cyclotron, or a bacteria's life. And you can tell that those are stories to be told. Many years ago, Joe Palka, who is a science editor, he asked me to write a story about entropy, and I created this song about this little I'm raking leaves, and I hear these bacteria. I hear this little sound. I get down on my knees, and I hear this bacterium and there's a bacteria that does this. This is great. He found it for me. That was decomposing the leaves. And in fact, this is the bacteria that is making everything fall apart on the planet. That's leading to entropy. And so they're singing this little song about entropy. So, if we take a step away from, I got to make sure they know these facts, and think, what stories can I tell about this? Then it puts things into context and makes people care more. So I think there's a lot of ways to do it. You know, if you give me an example, what we need to teach, I could come up with 4. Not that I know that much about any one of them, but you can make guesses.
Yeah. Louise, thanks.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. So if you're good at telling stories, what's the thing that you're good at? Like, what's the gift?
You know, one of the things that's really interesting to me about being a storyteller is when you get into it is you realize what – it's a wide skill set that's kind of required. But I think – well, first of all, it's just not rocket science. It's mostly doing it over and over and over again. It's like those 10,000 hours. You have to love language. You have to be able to see what's – central to being a human being. In terms of being a performer, and this is the hardest thing, and I still don't know how to teach it, is there's a great power that comes in relaxation, because when you're calm, then things occur to you that never occurred before. And I don't think any good storyteller tells a story exactly the same way twice. And that kind of stuff only happens when you're present in the moment. So there's a lot of preparation required so that what's required to be feel present in the moment. It's just a hard thing to get to, because it's that connection with the audience. I mean, I try to make eye contact with the people in the audience so that they feel like I'm talking to just them. And that is really, maybe that's the kind of finest art, is to tell the story to the people in the room,
right?
Not the people in your head, or the imagined audience, but the people in the room. And that means you adjust your tone of voice. It means you adjust your language. It means the dynamics. And that's kind of the Holy Grail, I think, in some ways.
Is there a difference between memorizing a story and then saying that memorized story and telling a story?
Yeah, there is. And I have some stories I tell that are memorized or recitation, things like that. And that is, I mean, I think the challenge of actors is to take these words that are on page. Taking a word on the page is dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally dead. And getting off the page is very, very difficult. So you have to get to the point where you don't see the page anymore. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But storytelling that's not memorized starts with image, and it moves through thought to language. And so that's a train. And so a story does not start with words. It starts with image and the stringing together of images. And the words – now, after I've told a story 100 times, I figure it takes me 30 or 40 times telling a story for an audience before I begin to understand it. It has to hang in there that long. But after 100 times, the language forms itself, and you kind of do this. You find the way to say it. But it's not – the story's always bigger than the words. And that's the difference between, I think, a recitation I guess an actor would say, though, they're always finding a different way to say the words. But a storyteller is always a possibility of finding a new way to say it, I think.
Because you've talked about this where you've said no matter how far we travel into the world of written language, it's done against the backdrop of sounds spoken into the air.
Yeah, because when we look at the word on the page, we can hear that sound.
Yeah.
We can hear that sound.
So it becomes an image.
Yes, and that's the mind-blowing thing to be about humans is you see C-A-T on the page,
yeah,
and it has no relationship. And this goes back to the Greeks, and I mean, where the Greeks were the first with separated sound from, you know, the letters. But you see C-A-T and you have a picture in your cat in your head. Now that is – it still is amazing to me. It's just – I just can't believe that happens. But we were oral first. We're oral first when we were born. The humans were oral, and we forget that literacy comes out of orality sometimes. That educational system forgets that if they don't have an orality, the literacy is going to be really tough. Those kids, I've been a teacher, artist in residence at this one school in inner city Providence for years, and those kids come in, and if no one has told them a story, and if no one has sung to them and they haven't sung, they're going to have a hard time. You see it on the first day of kindergarten. You can pick them out. You know right away.
Bill Harley is with us. His most recent books are Night of the Spadefoot Toads and Dirty Joe the Pirate. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's going to be in concert at the Masonic Temple in Salt Lake City. It's a benefit for the Writers at Work Scholarship Program, and seats are still available. For tickets, call 801-996-3313. You can buy them at the door as well, by the way, or go to our website for the particulars, radiowest@kuer.org. Bill is also giving a workshop as part of the Writers at Work Conference, which runs tomorrow through Sunday. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Humans using energy to take them near and far, burning up the fossil fuels in airplanes, trucks, and cars. They think that they're the masters at creating entropy, but they are only amateurs next to my friends and me. That's right. They don't know nothing about using up energy.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The storyteller Bill Harley is with us today. He's here in town speaking at the Writers at Work conference, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So at what point did you start telling stories to children? I mean, children, has it always been that part of it? Or
yeah, I had a rather mistaken assumption that you could actually have a career performing for both adults and kids. But, you know, culture just – they don't know what to do with it. And I still do both. Like the show I'm doing tonight is an adult show. But I worked with kids early on, I mean, just from the very beginning. I found that they responded to me, and I actually genuinely find kids interesting. And so that was always my work. And I mean, when I made my first album, my friend Steve Snyder, who produced my first album, I said, should I do the adult album? Should I do the kids album? Can't figure out one. He said, well, what are people asking for? I said, well, there's a lot of people who want some of my kids' songs. He said, well, do that. Yeah. And that was kind of – that was, you know, two roads diverge in a yellow wood, and sorry, I could not travel both. There we were. And it's an interesting trip too, because, you know, my take, if you work with kids, inherently your work is devalued. It's just something that happens. And you – everybody who works with children has to make – their peace with it or find – accommodate that somehow. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, you know, I'm kind of – you fight with. I think the people that know get it, but it's just one of those things that happens inevitably. You know, people say, wow, you run a Grammy? I said, yeah. Oh, wow. What was it in? Oh, it was a storytelling album for kids. Oh, I got to go. It just – it happens. I see it I see the change in their face. You're not that interesting anymore.
Wait, why? Why?
I don't know because I don't – well, I don't
– Because there's no irony in it or in this, that's the assumption that it's not.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a little confusing to me, but I just think because, you know, you must be working with kids because you can't work with adults. I don't know. I think there's a little bit – I think there is – I think there just is that. And so my determination was to make material for kids and for families that was going to work on a number of different levels and be as good as – and still be as good as good an artist as I can.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing about kids is, I mean, they're so immediate. It's a lot more. Both my sons are musicians and artists, and one of them said to me, "You know, I'm playing in a bar, and I'm playing these songs that are really important to me, and I'm just kind of looking out there at people drinking beer, thinking." This is not just getting that much back from it, as opposed to me. The next, you know, I go into a school, and it's like, wow, I know I'm making a connection. I know in some little way, if only for 45 minutes, I'm making a difference in some kid's life, at least if it's just to get them out of math class.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that song, Grown Ups Are Strange.
Yeah.
You want to say something about that? When did you come up with this?
Well, this is actually it was kind of an assignment because I – for me, I wrote this a number of years ago, but I had a couple stories on a storytelling album, and I looked at it, and I kind of needed some kind of binding agent. And the stories were about two weird grown-ups. And so I said, okay, I'm just going to make up a song, stories, grown-ups are strange. And that was, like I said, you know, I think artists need to give themselves assignments a little bit.
Right.
Rather than, so anyway, here's what we did.
Listen to me. Gather round, all of you kids, don't you make a sound. I got something to tell you. I want to give you the news. I want to talk about something that could happen to you. I'm talking about grown-ups, what they call adults. They're very strange, but it's not their fault. Once they were kids, they were good as gold. But then they got weird, cause then they got old. Grown-ups are strange, that's a fact, but you got to go forward, you can't go back. Grown-ups are weird, yes, that's true. Someday, it could happen to you. Grown-ups get to be in charge, they get to stay up late, they get to drive their cars. They make the rules and they say what's what. They can talk until they drive you nuts. Something happened since they were kids. You know their brains do not work like they once did.
You ask them a question cause you think they're there, and they say, huh? They give you a stare, yeah. Grown-ups are strange. That's a fact, but you've got to go forward. You cannot go back. Grown-ups are weird, yes, that's true. And ha, 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 it's gonna happen to you. Grown-ups are strange. That's a fact, but you got to go forward. You can't go back. Grown-ups are weird, yes, it's true. But someday, it'll happen to you.
Bill Harley is with us. So you've described that place in between being an adult and being a child. It's kind of that, like you're in this weird netherworld, I think is how you described it.
Yeah. You mean the world I live in right
now?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I think, you know, when you spend time something, you get better and doing it. And I managed to see – I've said in other places, when I was a kid, I kind of held the adult world at arm length, and I still do. And I think that the – I mean – Doug, my career is just so weird and it just kind of doesn't fit in anywhere. But I've kind of found a way to do that. And so I think it's an artist's job to look at the world and try to show it in a different way. And that's kind of still what I'm doing. My work with kids is I'm always saying, how does this look from a kid's position? Kid's perspective, and that's kind of one of my jobs. Not so, and I said it's not my work is not supposed to be prescriptive. I think prescriptive is as much as is descriptive. Yeah. With the faith, it's like, does this happen to you? Is the starting point for people thinking about things rather than you should do this. This is the way to behave, and it assumes kind of the intelligence of the audience, even if I do use the word underwear. So.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's take a call from Stephanie, who's in Greenville, South Carolina. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great. I just wanted to comment on your comment just a few minutes ago regarding how you feel like working with children takes you down a notch or two in the professional level.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a teacher and teacher turned freelance writer and stay-at-home mom. And my comment to you is that what I've learned as an educator and now as a mother is that people don't really know what to do with children. You think that they do, that it's just easy to work with kids and talk with kids, but I think it's the exact opposite. And I don't think that they look at you and think, you're not as good as anyone else. I think they look at you and think, wow. That's really a cool thing, and I don't even know what to add to it.
Yeah,
that's
you know,
what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that needs to be said. I mean, I get as much affirmation for my work as almost anybody I know. That happens. I mean, the people who know my work, that's you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right about that.
Well, I say keep doing what you're doing, and heavens knows we need lots of support for children, and it's fabulous that you're teaching them voice. Voice is a wonderful thing to have.
Thanks a lot. Same to you.
Stephanie, cheers.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You too. Have a great day.
You too. So I know there are a lot of us who, you know, fret about the effect of technology on, you know, human connection and human culture. I mean, do you worry about that? Or do you figure that we'll always find a way to tell stories?
You know, I do have great faith in resilience of humans. It is really interesting what's happening. How technology is affecting us. I'm just reading, and I can't remember the guy's name, the guy who wrote The Shallows, his book, but is the internet making us stupid?
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of that book, and I think a lot about that related to kids because we do – one of the things we know in brain science now, and I'm interested in that because trying to figure out story works, is that the technology conditions the way we see the world. And I don't know – I'm not convinced that texting and this constant influx of information really provides us a way where we can have some deep way of thinking about things. And that kind of focus is really important, I think, for a considered life. And I think when it's – I always think of this Gary Larson cartoon where the amoeba is sitting or the paramecium sitting watching television and his wife comes in and says, stimulus response. Is that all? Is that all it is? And I kind of feel like there's a lot – I do feel that there is a lot of that today, that I do a little monologue in some of my stories about boredom. It's like kids don't have a chance to be bored anymore, and boredom is what leads to really interesting stuff. It's like you just need this open space. And artists know that too. You need a dead space. You need a wasteland in order for things to grow. And when there's this constant input, that never really happens. So, yeah, it is of some concern. And the people who are leading that, they don't know where it's going either.
Yeah.
They think they know, but they don't know what the effect of this is. We don't. None of us know.
I read your bio right, you have or had two beehives?
I do. I have got a couple hives. I'm a horrible beekeeper, but it's so fascinating I can't stop. Yeah.
At what point, when did you do that? You love them?
It is just the most amazing world. And I'd wanted to do it for about 20 years. I started about 8 or 9 years ago. And it's like gardening, which like every year something rears its ugly head and happens that you can't imagine. But they have their own, you know, it's their own world, and you're just trying to keep them there. And they've got their own way of being. I mean, it's really a lesson in swarm theory that there's this knowledge in the swarm, and it's not in the bee, it's not in the queen, it's not in the worker, it's not in the drone. It's just kind of there. I was 2 weeks ago. I was out working. We've had a really warm spring, you know, and where I live in Massachusetts, the blossoms were about 3 weeks ahead. Yeah. And bees tend to swarm in late May or early June. You have to keep an eye on the hive to make sure that they've got enough supers on. And they swarmed like on May 3rd or April 29th. And I was working one of the hives, and all of a sudden there were just 25,000 bees in the hive just going away. And I was like, you guys or girls, that's not fair. That is not fair. Because now that hive's weak, and I'm never getting, you know, this, now we're not going to get any honey this year. But it's beyond our control. So it's just amazing.
Bill Harley, he is here, of course, at the Writers of Work Conference, giving a performance tonight. Go to our website for the details. Bill Harley, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Well, you know I'd be glad to share what I have, and that's what friends are for. If the job that you've got just...